Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is me. It's Peter Breggin with a cold. You can hear I'm a little nasal and stuffy, but thank God I have the most energetic guest that I've ever had at my conferences and on the air. And we'll get to Michael Corrigan in a couple of minutes. It's so good, again, as always, to have you here, to know midweek, Wednesday, I get to talk to my folks, and more, my folks get to talk back and talk back with me, not just at me or to me. Today is September 12th, 2018. If you're listening to this and it's not September 12th, you can't call in. But if it is September 12th, you can call in. And you listen to the show, folks. Remember this, because so many of you are not listening live but are downloading it. You remember that you listen on PRNFM, www.prnfm. But you call in to talk at 4 p.m., between 4 p.m. and 5 p.m., on a Wednesday, and that's New York time. All these details because we have a broad listening audience that needs to know where we are and so on and so forth when they pick us up from some different source. And the call-in number, again, 888-874-4888. And we're handled wonderfully on this show by Alex and by Jesse. Alex handles the phones, and blessing to have him there. And remember, you can communicate with me, and many of you are, on a dedicated mail just for this show, BregginLive@Hotmail.com, BregginLive@Hotmail.com. And we've set up a breaking news to cover things that I talk about on this show. I'm not sure I'm going to do the breaking news today. I'll see how we run. I'm very glad to have it there. It's every day, and it's got interesting things on it. And one of the things that you'll find on it that you're not going to find on other places is not just criticisms of psychiatry. You're going to find out about the latest we're learning about love and relationship, because the not the antidote, but the elixir of life is love, caring, connecting, supporting each other. I mean, that's just the key here to life. And we're going to have stuff on about it, and we'll be talking about it today. And, of course, you can search our archive. You get to the archive off of Breggin.com, and it's all alphabetical. After you've heard talk with Michael Corrigan, you can go there and look up the other times he's been on this show. So we're going to talk about children today and foster children and children at home and what do children really need. Michael Corrigan is a psychologist. He is a teacher at a university. He's also got a very interesting independent research program that he's developed with someone I put him in touch with, Bob Foltz, whom you can also look up, F-O-L-T-Z, and hear another inspiring person who's really doing everything he can to teach children. And Michael Corrigan, by the way, if you want a speaker on children's issues, he does the best presentations with the best animation and the best ideas. And I'm really giving him a build-up because I want to sit back and unleash Michael Corrigan on you. Michael, are you there?
I think I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, you think you are. This does not sound full of energy. Michael's worn out. He's been taking care of sick family members, temporarily ill children.
Yeah.
And I got so interested in talking with Michael that I ran overtime getting ready for the show. And didn't have time to think through a lot of how I wanted to do an introduction. We just suddenly said, oh, my God, we've been talking. And so, Michael, tell people what you're doing, because what you're doing is very interesting. And let's work it around eventually to the, this is the beginning of the school year. And do you really want to put your kid on psychiatric drugs? Because if you're thinking about putting your kid on psychiatric drugs, you know, hang in there with us for today. And if you've just started your child on psychiatric drugs, you may find a better approach is still available to you. The one thing you can't do is if your child's been on drugs for weeks or months, you just can't take them off. You need some help. And remember my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, because that will give you a lot of information about how to go about helping your children come off drugs and how to help your children not use drugs, any kind of drugs, including psychiatric drugs. And also thinking about today being back to school, I've written two books that are very inexpensive online, Talking Back to Ritalin and the Ritalin Fact Book. They're about the psychiatric drugs in children, Talking Back to Ritalin and the Ritalin Fact Book. And Michael's written some very good stuff too. And let me hand it over to you. Take a breath. I'm going to take a breath and hand it over to you, Michael.
All right. Well, my name's Mike Corrigan. I'm a professor at Marshall University. I teach child development, statistical analysis, research methods. Done a bunch of federal research over the years for the National Science Foundation, U.S. Department of Ed, Department of Justice. And what I like to research is character development in kids and just how to help them live a better life. Peter mentioned my book. The last one I wrote was called Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. And then before that, I've written several books on the handbook of pro-social education, you know, putting the F word back into schools, fun. And also multidimensional education, a common data-driven approach to education, how we can help kids do better and enjoy school better. So it's a lot of what I do. Most recently, Bob Foltz joined my company, and we've teamed with Oracle and a company called Helix Business Solutions, and we've developed a system called Vital Child at vitalchild.solutions. And this is a system for child welfare to track the safety of kids that are in foster care or being monitored by CPS. So we've been doing a lot of work on that, and that's one of the things I was talking to Peter about is one of the things we've made our system do is be trauma-focused because, as so many know, typically when you are visited by CPS, it's a traumatic experience for a child regardless, and it turns out that about 4 out of 5 kids coming into child welfare have had traumatic experiences, or ACEs, they like to call them. So what we've been trying to do and work on is have Oracle bring our assessment system and our way to track kids' life via mobile tablets and cell phones. And so these caseworkers and social workers have everything they need right in front of them when they need it, with integrated care passports tracking the history of what's happened to the child and so many different things like that.
One of the things you and I have been talking about is what services do kids need? And my own orientation, we haven't talked about this much lately on the air, but it's sort of in the air as I talk. And that is that what children always need as a start is parents who are able to help them, to discipline them, to love them, to enjoy them. And all parents often need different combinations of that to learn, because the welfare of children is all about parents. And if it's foster parents, then it has to be all around foster parents. And one of the things that I tell parents who come to see me, and I do a lot of this kind of work, is I'm not even in the beginning going to look at, and maybe you'll never want to really delve deeply into what you did wrong, if you did a lot of things wrong, but we don't know that, but let's assume you did. That's not what we're going to start out talking about. This isn't going to be you and your husband and the children airing the grievances. We're going to start out right today learning to respect and love one another. And I'll talk about this. Do you love your dad? You know, I usually get pretty good and honest answers about it that leave lots of room for hope. And when I see the mother and the husband and the wife separately, I'll ask them, you know, do you love each other? And I usually get answers we can work with. And then I work with helping them learn to teach their children that it's safe to love. And there's a part of the safety from loving being loved and loving with adults. They need to be respectful. And that we expect respect to start in the sessions. And if a child gets disrespectful, I intervene in my sweet way and I explain to them what respect is. unless they're very, very disturbed, which is rare, they get it right away. They may lose it and need some help, but they get it right away. And they want the parents to get it. Then they say, well, what about dad? He screams at mom or mom yells at us. And well, okay, and then we work on that. So the model for me of helping children is very straightforward. You help and support the adults who are taking care of them. And in the process, you also are helping the children to take care of the adults and to take care of each other. So that's my basic model. I give it back to Michael for comment here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great model, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. But with foster care or even community health, where it's sometimes a slightly different clientele you're seeing as a therapist. You know, my wife Amanda is still working in community mental health. Sees anywhere from 6 to 8 patients in an 8-hour day, and somehow has to figure out how to do all of her notes in that same 8-hour day. And for caseworkers and folks traveling around within child welfare and foster care, you know, they're seeing one person after another. And unfortunately, what many states are encountering now is this opioid addiction has just overloaded the foster system. Indiana, for example, went from around 12,000 kids in the system about 5 years ago to, like, I think 28,000, 29,000 now. A lot of states like Indiana just don't have enough foster homes to take care of these children. It's a whole different thing where you don't necessarily always have the parent there to work with. In some instances, and sometimes you do have the parents there, but they also have their major issues. They're not just coming in for the child who had a out of family traumatic experience. The trauma could come from the family. So what we're trying to do with the child welfare agencies we're starting to work with is help them see that there's a more efficient way to gather this comprehensive information you need to know about this child into a system, so that we can start collecting data on what's going on with the child, what they've been exposed to, what they're dealing with, what kind of help they need, what services they have, how well it worked, so that we can help them figure out what's working with these kids that have been traumatized due to opioid addiction within the house, or kids that have gone through different events. But unfortunately, what happened historically over the past few decades since the pharmaceutical movement really grabbed hold to adolescents and youth is that so many of these kids come into foster care and they ask them, you know, are you depressed? And of course you're depressed. You're going into foster care, right? Suddenly they've got a depression diagnosis. They're not paying attention in class. Suddenly they've got an ADHD diagnosis. They're having anxiety issues. Now they've got an anxiety disorder, you know. Before you know it, they're on 3 to 12 pharmaceuticals, and we're also treating the side effects of those. So states like Missouri have been sued most recently for allowing or not keeping control of so many kids being drugged within foster care. So there's this movement within child welfare that they really want to find a holistic, systemic way. And what I was trying to ask you, Peter, was like, you know, we're collecting the data to help them diagnose, I'll use air quotes, you know, figure out what's going on with the child, and we're providing them with the system to track the care and the progress of the child. But, I mean, so many of these states, just they don't have enough money to hire enough staff to treat this many kids. Some of these kids are waiting 2 to 3 months just to see a therapist to get started and within community health and within child welfare. So there's a need there, and that's why I brought it up with you, is I just think there's a need for the, you know, community of those interested in psychology to really start thinking about how we can start helping states out with this. Because there's also a new, so CWIS is the new policy that they're being forced, many are being forced to adopt in order to keep a lot of title money. They got to adopt a new Comprehensive Child Welfare Information System, CCWIS. So many are looking for new technology to assess these things we're talking about for case management and beyond. But then there's a new policy coming out, it looks like next fall, called the Family First Prevention Services Act. And what that is going to do, instead of states which have been forced in the past to basically take the child in as a ward of the state in order to get federal monies to pay for them, their care, the federal government's starting to allow them with this new Family First Prevention Services Act to leave the child within a home for up to 12 months, and they'll pay for the services to try to help that child and that family. So I know a lot of states are looking for input as to what is the best family therapy to do with this, these more specific, maybe more vulnerable families and children that we see within child welfare and foster care. And I know many of them are also in need of help just to figure out how to even provide family therapy and how to train foster parents better to be prepared to help these kids they're taking into their homes.
Well, there are a lot of programs that have been experimented with over the years that focus on training parents. And that, to me, is the key, or foster parents. And a lot of them evolved in the inner city. So they're programs that are calculated to be run relatively inexpensively, which means that you have a group of people that meet with one or two professionals to talk with the professionals and among themselves and get support for how do you maintain a loving attitude towards your kids under stress. How do you exert discipline? What are the best approaches to it? So I think there's a great deal of resources that are available that may differ from place to place, but they're all going to have a few things in common where they're going to be teaching parents that they have to be a moral authority in their family. They have to be present in the family. They have to be interested in the children and care about them and love them and manage to stay in touch with loving while they take on the difficult tasks of discipline, and to get to talk among each other about it. You know, my own books contain some information about that. I think that what you're looking at would require a search of programs. I know there are some in Philadelphia. I know somebody in Philadelphia who could probably help you with that. We can talk about it after the show, about contacting her. But I think that the advantage of what you're describing is good in that it says they're not mentally ill, they're traumatized. But I don't think the advantage goes to what services do traumatized children need that are unique. All children need the same thing. They all need their caretakers, their teachers, their coaches, their ministers, their foster parents, their parents, to be aware of how to be a moral authority who is loving and who teaches children at the same time boundaries and restraint. It's about respect and love. That's what children, I think, most fundamentally get. I don't think the children need services. I think that the main service in terms of parenting, in terms of the family well-being, is the training of whoever is leading the family, whoever's there, giving them training and support in how to be a parent. I think that's the absolute key. And then the family may need services. The father or may need help getting a job. The mother may need some respite, if any of that's available. And all that costs some money, not anywhere near as much as a hospitalization and drugs for the rest of your life. But I hope you don't lose the forest for the trees. The real issue is encouraging these states to deliver what's really needed, which is individual or group or seminar, or maybe some video help or whatever, help in being good parents. That's what's needed. And in that context, parents can see that drugs aren't the answer. That's what I'm thinking anyway. Tell me your thoughts. And we're talking with Michael Corrigan, an old friend of mine who is a little quiet today. Hi, come back. Interrupt me.
Fine. I agree with you, but my friends at Love and Logic are parenting group that I've worked with and studied and researched for them for years, and I know a bunch of folks that have great programs like that. But I know some individuals have brought trauma to the forefront before, but it's truly, I mean, there's just a major need right now to help these. And I like the idea of not having to treat kids. Unfortunately, it just seems that the way the policy works, if they show these signs during a risk and safety assessment or during a, you know, and then basically are sent to get a clinical assessment, they start treating for mental disorders immediately. And you know as well as I do that then, you know, some of them read the different oath than most people and somehow feel they're ethically obligated to medicate at that point. It's a different world, and I think part of it's due to, you know, how the insurance is paid through the title monies and different things. But I do think there's a need for training the parents and the foster parents. But I also think there's just a need, and maybe you can focus on it someday when you got free time. That's a joke.
I didn't hear really, enough of it to get the joke. Say it. Come on. Say it again.
When you have free time, I said.
Yeah, when I have free time. Yeah. Well, I have free time for the things I believe in. So let's talk some more. Go ahead.
But I think a lot of these therapists that are in community health that are working with these foster children and families and CPS that are, you know, court obligated to go see, you know, they're working in agencies where these people go through the psychiatrist first, you know, and not all of them have a psychiatrist that says, don't send them to me if you don't want them drugged. And what happens is that they're trying to figure out how do I treat trauma? And I do think a number of people could still use some guidance on how to do that. And the question is, how do we treat so many? That's what I'm trying to get through to you is, like, how do you treat 29,000 kids a year in Indiana? How do you treat, you know, 7,500 kids a year in Kansas? And although some of these programs might work well in an urban area, you mentioned that, the vast majority of states in America have a lot of rural property, you know. And when you get to these agencies that are out in the rural areas, they have fewer case managers, there's fewer hospitals, resources, therapists. So it comes down to resources and who's available to help. And how do we create, you know, a more evidence-driven approach to doing what works for them instead of continuing things that haven't worked? Because I know there's these programs out there, but unfortunately, if you've watched foster care over the last two decades, it just keeps exploding. It comes down to parenting at home.
Let me be blunt in what I'm thinking. I mean, it almost sounds, and I'm a little surprised, that you've just accepted the system. I think you have a risk-benefit calculation to make in your program, which is, do you dare push the truth? And the truth is that all that stuff that's going on and being done is a bunch of crap. and that we know what children need, and we've always known what they need. Even going back to the early studies on incest families, a number of these were done in Scandinavia, where a lot of the studies are done because they have, as you know, these big data banks. The children, even who'd gone through incest, tended to do better if they stayed in the family, the incest stopped and they got help, than if they were just taken out and put in foster care. So this new legislation you're talking about sounds like a miracle, potential miracle, where they're going to allow people to get the services in the home. And I think you should just put your weight behind that. And you have to take the risks that everybody working in the system takes, which is how much are you going to say the truth? And the truth is that the kids don't need services. They don't need doctors other than a pediatrician once in a while who swears off drugs. What they need is the interventions of through various means of helping parents parent better. And in this day and age, I'm doing a program, as some of my folks out there know, but within several months, we're going to have out a program on how do people help each other. Right? There's an alternative program that people can watch. How do you help people? What's your attitude toward children, your attitude toward each other? How do you help people? It's that kind of thing that they need. And whether they watch videos or they go into a classroom once a week in the evening, however it gets delivered to them, and it would be wonderful if you and Bob could find a wedge into being leaders in that arena, that's what needs to be done. And there's nothing we can do about people getting shunted to the psychiatrist except stand up for reality as best we can. And then everybody like yourself who's working in the system has a calculus to make, which is tough, which is how far do I push it and risk getting fired, in which case I'm gone? And should I push it all the way and then go somewhere else? Or what do I do? And you know what to do. So I think some of it is just, you know, how much are you willing to bend what you're doing? To tell people what's real, which you know to it. You know as well as I know, and I'm sure in some ways better. So, I mean, I'm sort of confronting you a little bit. What do you think,
obviously,
Michael?
You haven't read my work on this. It's hard to cover up the fact that you wrote a book called Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging
Other
Kids.
Yeah,
the Lancet, top international medical model for putting out fake research. So I'm not hiding that, and Bob and I are definitely saying our system can basically put an end to drugging children and have a better approach. What I'm trying to share with you, but we're about assessing and tracking is what we're doing right now. We only have so much time in the day as two human beings working with a large corporation. But what I'm trying to share is that for folks out there that want to make a major difference, there are no programs that are currently working in foster care that are doing miracles right now. And my point I'm trying to make is that there is a major need within this child welfare world, this sector, for people to come up with great ideas to start addressing some of these issues at hand, because it's not about someone coming in paying $100, $180 an hour to get therapy. It's a world where there's not enough help, and they need help, but they need, and by the way, our system, there's so many systems being sold right now, and all they're trying to do to jump through the policy hoop is your case manager will now have a tablet, and they can do a risk and safety assessment that'll tell them if they need to remove the child or leave the child in the home.
Yeah.
Our system's for everybody across child welfare, because we believe that's a Band-Aid, and it's not going to help anybody in child welfare to just give a tablet to a caseworker. That's going to help them, but it's not going to help them work with their leadership. It's not going to help them work with residential treatment. It's not going to help them work with service providers. You know, everybody needs to be on that same system. So the system we're proposing is light years ahead of what others are out there. So we are putting our foot down and saying, you know, if you really want to make a measurable difference, you need to do something extremely different. And ours is holistic, it's systemic, it's modular, it connects everybody. But what I'm saying is we have to focus on trauma first, because for those of us who have been there and done that,
I think it's fine to focus on trauma. I think it's great to focus on trauma because that gets you away as you want to get away from the medical model. It gets you into the real life model that people have problems for reasons. Children are suicidal for reasons. They're angry and rageful for reasons. They're withdrawn for reasons. They hate school for reasons. So, and the reasons can always be couched in some variation on trauma, especially if you expand trauma to include negligence and absent parents and dysfunctional families. So I'm puzzled, though, because what you're essentially asking me is something that I don't think is a puzzle. It's just a political issue. How in the world do you convince the world? What do you do to get the services that we know children need, which are services to improve their families? We know that's what they need.
You're not. I'm suggesting that your next project be a piece that teaches people how to help folks in child welfare and foster care. I'm not asking you. I'm my friends at Love and Logic, I've reached out to them. I'm like, here's a perfect opportunity to take your parenting expertise to a population that really needs your help. And that's all I'm saying is we've been assessing K-12 schools for a decade, you know, or more now. My consulting company of $20 million in grants. And we've kind of gotten away from school assessment because we just feel more passionate about helping child welfare figure out how to, you know, be evidence driven, how to improve things. So all I'm saying, Peter, I mean, I've thought about it. I have my own thoughts and answers. I'm not asking you to solve the world today. I'm just saying it's an amazing world that needs a lot of help, and it needs amazing people like you and your listeners to contribute to it.
Well, I think that's right. And I think it's a massive political issue because we do have a lot of approaches to helping children and through helping their families and schools. You can go into a school and improve it, and you improve the lives of the children. You can run a school properly, and all the kids drop off their ADHD diagnoses and stop drugs. We actually have these examples, and there's many different kinds around the country and around the world. And I probably should have some of them on the air, come to think of it. I haven't been focusing on all those alternatives.
A thing in New York, though, where you're at, caseworkers in New York City and even other cities around there, Albany, some of them have caseloads of 45 kids or more.
That's why it's a political issue.
Well, it's a funding issue for sure. And
yeah, that's right. It's a funding issue. But beyond that, funding isn't going to do a damn thing unless, as you know, the model changes.
Exactly.
It's like, I wrote a blog. Not too long ago, wrote a blog saying more psychiatry means more school shootings. And I'm sure you agree with that. So it's not just funding mental health or funding this or funding that. It's funding the resources in a family or a foster home or even a school for what children need. And what they need is informed attention from adults. And how to deliver it, you can do it in various ways depending on the money. I think the biggest issue is that the system never wants to go in that direction because it's run by psychiatry, it's run by mental health, it's run by the medical professions, it's run by the politicians, and all of them are interested in building bureaucracies and services and getting services funded. And to them, I don't think they even think that helping a parent learn to be a parent is a service. it's changing that whole huge model, right?
Well, I think there's a lot of people in child welfare that have hearts bigger than yours and mine combined that want to do that stuff. I just think, unfortunately, I went through No Child Left Behind as a federal researcher. And watched so many folks read like 3 pages out of the, hundreds of pages that was long and say, oh, we need to increase proficiency scores. And they didn't look at all the good stuff that was in No Child Left Behind. And a lot of schools did the bare minimum to try to raise these scores high enough so they could keep the money coming in. You do that to some degree out of desperation because you need the money to keep the doors open and to buy, you know, food and toilet paper, you know, and books. And unfortunately, child welfare is more broke than any education system. And now they're being told to buy these million-dollar systems. And now they're also trying to figure out where do we find those millions of dollars. By the way, we're understaffed. We're overloading these young caseworkers that want to help. And they're quitting because they're so frustrated they can't do anything. And what do we got to do to create our accountability report for the year? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's more than that. And I mean, if you read our research, we tell them we are looking to work with states that truly want to make a difference and become a leader in child welfare for change, to make a measurable difference, right? And that's what we're after. We know some folks just don't have the ability, the time, the resources, or the interest to do that, what we want to do. But what we're looking for are states that are tired of the status quo and see a system that puts them 10 years ahead and that can support their staff. And then we can actually start researching and tracking and monitoring the effectiveness of these different approaches that are being taken. But the opioid addiction is the major cause for
seeing
and child welfare right now. So it's a societal problem as well. And I'm just saying, you know, to me, if you read any of my blogs on Mad America, Psychology Today, or whatever, it's for the kids because they deserve nothing less than us.
Well, I know. Listen, I've had you to my conferences. I know what you think and feel, and I know it's very similar to what I do. I'm having a little difficulty fathoming what you're asking for, because I think what we need is for all of us to keep working our tails off to change society's views of what kids need. Maybe you and me and Bob and some others need to form a new organization about what kids really, 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 really need. Because that's what this is about. It's about influencing the school systems and politicians and society about what children really need, because it's gotten so sick, our culture, that it thinks children need drugs. It thinks 20% of our kids and if those druggers had their way, it'd be 50%, you know, of the kids had drugs. So we need re-inspiration, certainly, about getting together and telling people that what kids need is families. And if they have foster families, they need to improve them. And they need books and videos, and they need groups, and they need whatever is there in the community, to bring to people, instead of the awful TV they're watching about how families are supposed to behave, you know, where the children don't respect the parents and parents don't respect the children, and on. But I mean, what you're making me think is that I should get back to and build an organization about, which I could do with empathic therapy, about my empathic therapy center, you know, about, you know, what do kids need, folks? Listen up.
Right. Yeah, I'm just asking a lot of people. I mean, I know a lot of people listen to your show. I'm just not asking you. I'm just saying I think there's a great moment of change going on in child welfare.
This is wonderful.
No matter where you live, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, folks, you can call in. The lines are very unusually quiet today. Usually the lines are full, but they're quiet today. So call in and tell me and Michael what you think, or ask a question, 888-874-4888. It's 888-874-4888. I would like the questions to address, if possible, and maybe that's the problem, the children's issues. And folks just don't get aroused enough by children's issues. And remember that the last Wednesday of every month now is open mic, and that's when you can call in at the times I've described, 4 to 5 p.m. on Wednesday, New York time, the last week of the month. The last Wednesday of the month goes to open mics, call in. And remember that you can talk to me and tell me what you're thinking via the dedicated email, which is breganlive@hotmail.com. breganlive@hotmail.com. You know, Michael, we've had so many, again and again, we've found that things work well with kids, that the most disturbed and upset families that are going to cost the society hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for the rest of the child's life and maybe his children's lives and so on, that if you do a wraparound program where you put away a package for 1 or 2 years of that $100,000 and you bring in everything that family could need to grow and get out of its bad attitudes and its bad luck and its hardship and help them with work and help them with some housekeeping and teach the maybe 16-year-old child who's got one of the kids, you know, how to raise a child. You know, you just go in, find out what's the family needing to do it. And you educate that these work very, very well, but they don't sell to the legislatures and the legislators, and even though they are financially effective. And then we have all these other programs. So what I'm hearing is that you are facing how stymieing it is, if that's a word, stymieing it is, to go into these systems and develop a good way of identifying the kids and a good way of getting around the medical model and talking about that, you know, think of kids as trauma victims. Childhood's traumatic enough without having additional trauma. And you're trying to struggle with, well, how do we convince people to deliver services and what do we provide? That's somewhere where you're trying to talk with me today.
Yeah, it's a world of crisis for anybody that's worked in it. And I taught in the juvenile detention for a number of years. You know, every day is a crisis for these folks. Every call for a case manager, social worker, you know, investigator, you know, CPS operator. I mean, every moment is crisis. And what we're just trying to do is manage the crisis, manage the chaos a little bit better and organize it so that we're more informed about what's going on. And if we've seen 10,000 of these kids in this situation, do the analysis, collect the data that allows us to do the analysis, say, well, what worked in this situation? So that's what we're doing, is a lot of, you know, our goal in the end is to do a lot of data, high quality data collection across all the agencies so that we can do the regression analysis and the predictive modeling to say, you know, your best odds for success with this youth in this situation or this family in this situation is going these programs. But, you know, not every state has an evidence-based program that's showing, you know, evidence of working. So I just brought it up because I just like to hear your thoughts on things. But, you know,
no, you're getting them, and I'm enjoying it, stifling a little cough here and there. I'm really in very good health, folks. This is, by the way, the first illness like a cold that I've had in over a year since I've been on the plant-based, no dairy eating regimen. Lost 35 pounds, and I've been just so healthy. It's just been a miracle, and I'm hoping not to need an antibiotic and to get through this. But I am taking care of my lungs a little bit and my nasal passages. And the Lions have responded to my invitation. Duh. Why didn't I think of that? When I invited y'all to come and talk about children, I took a breath, we start to get callers. But Daryl and Bronx, what are you thinking about?
Dr. Bergen, what is Michael's last name?
Corrigan.
Corrigan. All right. I live in Co-op City in the Bronx. If you're familiar with that development, Dr. Bregan, it's...
No, I'm not. So go ahead and describe it.
Okay. I-95.
And Michael, you can chime in on this. We both are equals here on the calls. Go ahead.
It's a cooperative. It's the last cooperative before you leave New York City. 35 buildings. It's very huge. Just off of I-95. Anyway, it's got a very large youth population. It's what we used to call lower middle class, or actually, yeah, considering the economy, community. And there's a large youth population. And it's divided up into different sections. And the sections war with one another. And the reason I bring that up is because you were talking about the answer is parenting. The challenge that I hear both, and I was just as a quick aside, Dr. Corrigan, the numbers that you're speaking about out in the Midwest need to be magnified even more than quote unquote it's the center for the opioid addiction. People don't know, and therefore it's challenging for them to even understand. And what would also be helpful is to emphasize the ethnicity of those who are experiencing that, because during the teacher strikes in out in that area, I was appalled to see how little money is being expected to produce quality product. It's totally insane how we're allowing, with the amount of capital in this country, allowing people to starve, basically. 16 million children go to bed hungry. Getting back to the specific, it is, how do you provide time for the parent to be a parent when they're working three jobs and focusing on quote-unquote survival, when there's no necessity for any of that? The model is totally corrupt.
Yeah, you know, there are, one of the things I stress when I'm working with states now and you know, trying to explain how we're different is, we, you know, everybody knows Maslow's hierarchy of needs, whether you like it or not. But it goes to show you what we're not focusing on when we're talking about kids and child welfare or these vulnerable kids, you know, being monitored by CPS or investigated. Is, you know, a lot of times these basic needs aren't being met even in some homes. And, you know, I've taught in West Virginia for a number of years. I live in the Columbus, Ohio area now, but poverty across so many rural areas and Midwest is just amazing to me. And you know, a lot of these kids aren't being fed a daily meal. And, you know, there's a reason they go in for neglect or abuse, CPS. And the problem is, how do you pull them out when you have no place to go? And then how do you hold parents responsible or help them or train them to be better parents when a rogue boyfriend or a neighbor's, you know, half of them are addicted to different drugs? And I do bring up the addiction and those things going on. But I also know, and, you know, New York, I've had a number of talks with different counties and state agencies there. You have so many kids in that system in New York compared to, I mean, New York's child welfare system is probably as big as 15 states, you know.
Yes. How successful has that been? I mean, you have children going through that system, even if they have some kind of compassionate care from foster parents, and they come out, and at the age of responsibility, they're totally lost. It's gotten better in the last maybe five years or so, but we are destroying a whole generation. See, it was all right in the 70s and 80s to destroy the African-American population because it was just a bunch of crack addicts and crack babies. If you saw the Frontline special last night on Dayton, Ohio, and how they link the jobs to the parents being depressed, okay, that's great. Let's do it. What happens in the next 10 years when your work no longer defines your identity? What do you think happens then? We've gone through this with the steel crisis and the automobile crisis. People need to get an understanding that, quote-unquote, hard work only produces bad backs and sad minds. We need to use the technology that we have right now, the neuroscience and the epigenetic information and all kinds of things, wonderful things, to move people off this. If you ain't working, you ain't worth nothing, and I'm good because I work hard and I still don't get paid. It's crazy.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you're saying. I think that work is very good for people. I think what the country needs is more work that's more satisfying, more work that is involving the technology, that is producing things. But I think work is a good thing for people. So I'm not sure, Dara, where you're going with all of that. I think people need to be responsible. They need to feel they're contributing to the country, and they need to feel they're contributing to their communities.
Okay, but how do you do that in this particular capitalist system? How do you do that? You're not hearing what I'm saying.
I don't want to go into it. I think that we're seeing a lot of progress in this country right now. We're seeing, I think, the happiness quotient going up. We're seeing people with more and more jobs. I think we're seeing changes right in front of our eyes. Listen, I'm gonna say goodbye on this because I don't want to just talk about the politics, but I've let you go a bit, and I wanted to just say what I wanted to say about it. Our last caller had a question and dropped out. The question is the side effects. Oh, good. Oh, she's back. Sandy, are you there? I thought I'd lost
Hi.
You.
Hi. Hello?
Hi, Sandy. Were you gone for a minute?
Never.
Never. So listen, go ahead. Guys, what were you going to ask?
Good program. I'm concerned, and I'm sure that you're concerned, aren't you, about the side effects of so many drugs on our kids. And I don't know how to say it correctly. I think it's tardic dyskinesia. And this is one of the things that I saw a lot in the older kids. And it frightens other kids. It makes it, you know, for the child, this antisocial environment, because nobody wants to be around kids that are shaking and doing all kinds of strange things. But I think the drugs, in the long run, are extremely dangerous. And I am I not in agreement with you guys? Is this what you're alluding to?
Yes, Sandy. Tell me, you like the show. What did you like about the show so far?
Finally, people are talking about family, love, and children.
Oh, and God bless you.
There's nothing better than that. I'm not kidding you. Because when you start teaching
let me tell you something about the... I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sandy. We have about 6 minutes, I imagine.
Oh, I'll be fast. And, when you start teaching kids at an early age, and I believe you got to get them in kindergarten, teach them, you know, how to take care of themselves, how to take care, you know, of their property, teach them how to be responsible. And it's fun to do that. Kids love organization. I know I worked with them forever, and they loved it. And, you know, the family, you got to have a family. You got to invest in the family, whatever that family unit is. And so that these kids are not lost, because once they're out of the system, and I met some, and I actually worked with some who were, I used to call them ex-babies of foster care, a lot of these young people were very lost, very wounded, very, very wounded. They had no roots, they really had no family, and they were very lost, sad. So the family, I believe, is crucial. Love is crucial. Starting children at an early age, learning how to take care of themselves, and, you know, how to really enjoy every day.
Thank you. You've inspired me, and then I will let Michael respond. You've inspired me. The show of September 26th, which is live talk, I will begin the show by talking about psychiatric drug adverse effects in children. And that'll give us a start. We're certainly not going to cover it today, and I won't even cover it then. But I'll talk about that on September 26th, psychiatric drugs, especially children. But it'll be a live talk where people can call in and talk about anything they want. I didn't talk enough about children last time, and I got chided by that by one of my listeners when I said I was going to talk about children. Michael, go ahead.
I was going to say, in my class, my students tell you, I teach future educators, future therapists, but I explain to them, I'm like, you have your DSM if that's where you want to go, but most of what we are going to see with students, we have to give the benefit of the doubt, is that it's either a normal human emotion they're experiencing that they could use some help with and some love and support. It's possibly a developmental delay, or they truly went through some sort of traumatic experience that they need help with. And I urge my students day in and day, every week. I mean, last week I had them repeat these words 4 times last night in my course, and that's developmental delay, developmental delay. Whenever we talk, what is that? It's developmental delay. And all I'm trying to do, and if you read any of my stuff, is get parents to just not jump on board with everything so quick and accept the bio model and go straight to drugs, because everyone we've met or worked with, Peter, I mean, no one really benefits from that. And when you do write a book about something like that, you get, you know, dozens of emails from people, if not hundreds, that, you know, lost their child to, you know, overdose due to those drugs. So there's nothing really good coming from it. And for many therapists out there, it's really kind of hard to treat a child who's being medicated to not think clearly. There's so much to what you say, and I appreciate it. When I was teaching in juvenile detention, I used to tell my kids to meet me at a shortstop teen center on the weekends where I volunteered in Columbus. So I'd like to hear about people who work with kids once they get out of the system, too. Thank you. It's hard.
Folks, we've got only a minute left, so let me close now.
And, thank you, guys.
Yeah, Sandy, call in again. Call in, especially on the 26th, okay? Because you inspired me to make that a theme.
Great show. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, dear. A few things. All psychiatric drugs, remember, they're neurotoxins. And Sandy mentioned a terrible neurotoxicity that all the so-called antipsychotic drugs, Zyprexa, Risperdal, Seroquel, it doesn't matter which one it is, they all cause this tardive dyskinesia, which is a permanent neurological deformity that leads to abnormalities in movement, and it can be a terrible, terrible thing. They're all neurotoxins. We shouldn't be giving neurotoxins to our children, period. Michael Corrigan, take a quick last word.
Get outside with them. Do something before it gets too cold.
All right. Enjoy your kids. Love your kids. Love one another. That's the message. That's the most important one we can give each other any time. And thanks again for listening to these various topics. And we'll keep tailoring it back and forth to what you feel you need to hear and what we feel we want to talk about in a wonderful combination. And do send me information on Bregan Live at hotmail.com. Thanks so much. Thank you.